recorded live on my dining room table, and then scripted, edited, sliced, diced, and pureed until it's a fine mush, it's The Mike Novak Show, still Chicago's only green gardening and environment program, all wrapped in a gluten-free flour tortilla and podcast until it's golden brown.
Good planets are hard to find. Temperate zones and tropic climes. And true currents and thriving seas. Wind blowing through breathing trees. Strong ozone and safe sunshine. Well, good planets are hard to find. Good planets are in demand.
Well, hello everybody, and thank you for joining me today. As usual, I've got way too much on my plate and trying to get in one short hour, so let's get started. Everything begins for this program last Sunday at the final day of the Chicago Flower and Garden Show, and I'm out there hawking my book, Attack of the Killer Asparagus, and who should walk by but entomologist Dr. May Barenbaum from the University of Illinois. I've interviewed her on my show a number of times. She's quite wonderful, and I thought, holy smoke, I can't pass up an opportunity to ask her about honeybees and how they're doing. And I imposed on her and gave her a free copy of the book as kind of a payment. And she said, okay. And we talked for a while, and we're going to start with that because there's a little bit of news, and she just sort of has a way of talking about this that is very scientific, but very accessible, and I think you'll find it interesting. In the second interview, I talk to Executive Director of the Illinois Environmental Council, Jen Walling, about a number of laws that are being proposed down in Springfield, as part of the General Assembly spring session, environmental laws, of course. And she tells me the status of those. They involve composting, they involve clean energy, and more. And then finally, for you Rick DeMille fans, I know you're jonesing for the Rick, and he's here. At the end of the program, we talk about the late spring snow and what it means, and climate change, as always, and I think you're going to find it fascinating. That's all on today's podcast. Stand by.
Captain's log, stardate 42326.1. The Enterprise is under attack by an apparently hostile life form. Mr. Worf, status report.
Inexplicable, Captain. They appear to be perambulating vegetables. We are being stalked by stalks of asparagus.
That is incorrect, Mr. Worf. Killer asparagus was the subject of a very popular 21st century tome by the brilliant author Mike Novak.
Mike Novak. I'm familiar with his work.
And so am I.
Mike Novak was one of the smartest, funniest people in the horticultural world of the 21st century.
Tell me more, Mr. Data.
He has been variously compared to Mark Twain, Dave Barry, and Edgar Allan Poe.
Raven Gosplach, my favorite holiday dish.
Thank you, Mr. Wolf. Mr. Data, options?
It seems to be available online at aroundtheblockpress.com.
Aroundtheblockpress.com. What do they have to say?
It appears that Mike Novak is a slapstick every gardener.
I prefer my asparagus with a side of patak-kakak.
Mr. Wolf, are you joking?
Actually, Captain, I believe he is choking.
Who knows when this is going to air, but I'm at the Chicago Flower and Garden Show, and who should stop by the booth? And so I had to give her a copy of Attack of the Killer Asparagus, but Dr. May Barenbaum from the University of Illinois, entomologist and friend of pollinators everywhere. Yeah, just got your thumbs up here. It's great to see you.
Oh, a pleasure. And thanks for the book. I really look forward to reading it. My lucky day.
Well, I'm happy to give it to you because I'm going to ask you to talk to me about the state of bees and pollinators in 2015 in at the end of March. You say there's actually some good news.
Some good news from for the honey producers. Honey yields are up for the first time in many years. There are, I think, 4% more colonies than there were last year at this time. So we're creeping back.
I saw a chart, and it's, I'm sure you've seen it too, and I was kind of surprised by it, that charts honeybee populations from 1945, and that's actually when they began their decline to the present. Is that significant in any way? Does that mean anything?
There are so many social and cultural changes starting in 1947, which is when the National Agricultural Statistics Service started censusing the number of hives. Profound changes in urbanization and you know, creation of the suburbs, and changes in land use, and changes in American diet that weren't particularly bee friendly. So it's hard to pinpoint any single factor, but a lot of changes did take place. And there was we have far fewer than half the number that we had in 1947 when the statistics National Ag Statistics Service started counting beekeepers.
Well, why is that significant? Does it mean anything? Because we have more people, I assume. We have to feed more people. We have fewer bees. What does that mean?
Well, the whole farm sector is changing. You know, back at the turn of the 21st century, the 20th century, something on the order of 20% of Americans lived on farm. Now it's way less than 2%.
Yeah.
So in general, there's just been a shift in how and where Americans live. So I think bees are part of that shift. So in that we are still depending on one species for managed pollination doesn't speak very well to our recognition of the importance of pollination services.
Well, that's a really good point. One of the things I've talked about on my show recently is the almond crop in California. And from what I understand, you can correct me if I'm wrong, approximately 60% of our honeybees go out to California every February to pollinate the almond crop. Now, is that dangerous in any way in terms of having all the bees in one place where a catastrophe could happen? And B, is it dangerous in that that's all they're consuming for this time that they're out there?
It's not optimal for so many reasons. As you say, the one reason that colony collapses order got so much attention is that, so the first reports came in fall 2006, but in February 2007, there were about 600,000 acres of almonds, and the growers were afraid there wouldn't be enough bees to pollinate them. So that's what propelled this story to the front, to the New York Times, because at the time it was, I think, a $2.5 billion industry. It's now something in the order of a $3.5 billion industry.
Yeah.
Every almond depends on the pollination services of a honeybee, and that's not a stable thing. I mean, if you had an investment portfolio, you wouldn't invest everything in one stock. So what we're doing is investing the only sort of commercially viable pollination service we are investing in is honeybees. And if something happens to them, we don't have many options. And there are 90-plus crops in the U.S. that depend on that one species.
Well, is it even possible to have the almonds pollinated with native pollinators?
There are pollinators, the other solitary bees, that are actually better at almond pollination than honeybees are. Almonds are not an optimal crop for honeybees. And as you point out, if you see what almond orchards look like, there is nothing else around. So a steady diet of any one thing, bees are gleaners like we are. They are designed to consume a diversity of crops. They here in Illinois, they're out in May, they forage through October. Of course, they're going to be visiting many, many different kinds of flowers. So they're not really built in an evolutionary sense to deal with one crop at a time, which is what migratory beekeeping depends on. So we're kind of going against their biology, and you know, they've had millions of years to perfect this, and we're kind of undermining it.
All right, what about pesticides? You and I have talked before, and you have said that pesticides are playing some role in bee decline and bee loss. It's hard to figure out or quantify exactly what that is, because bees have so many other threats, have so many other problems to deal with, like being shipped out to California, like varroa mite, like fungal diseases. Where are we in 2015 with pesticide use?
Well, we know a lot more. I mean, that's been really transformative. Up until colony collapse disorder, people didn't really even know how bees managed, how they process pesticides. When the honeybee genome sequence was published in 2006, one of the really startling findings is that honeybees have only one-third to one-half the number of detoxification genes that other insects do. So they're not particularly well equipped to deal with synthetic organic pesticides. And what we've done in managing bees for agricultural pollination is expose them not just a pesticides, many different kinds of pesticides at the same time. So they interfere with each other. Fungicides, for example, can synergize or potentiate insecticides. So we treat seeds not just with neonics, for example, but with fungicides as well, and they interact. So it's not just pesticides, it's how pesticides are being used. And honeybees, by the way, are, you mentioned these other scourges, including Nosema, which is a fungal disease, and the parasite varroa mites, and how do beekeepers treat them? With pesticides. Uh-huh. So bees can't escape them. They're home in their homes. The pesticides are being applied directly in beehives to control varroa mites and other pathogens and parasites. So here you have a system that is not equipped to deal with all kinds of poisons, and they not only have to deal with all the different phytochemicals that they encounter in nectars and pollens, but also in their own home. There are agricultural pesticides, there are beekeeper-applied pesticides. It's like not the world they are accustomed to.
Well, that sounds like a recipe for disaster, yet you say bee populations are going up a little bit.
Well, part of that is because our awareness has been raised. The almond industry, much to its credit, is partnering with a lot of bee-centric organizations to diversify plantings around orchards so that bees have supplementary resources. Fundamental to dealing with all these stresses is good nutrition, just like with humans.
Right.
So hungry bees or starving bees are going to succumb more quickly to effects of pesticides, pathogens, parasites, and everything. So I think the top priority and probably the easiest one technologically to achieve is to give them more different things to eat. And that's just win-win all around, because here we are at the garden show, you know? There are flowers galore. We like to look at them. Bees like to eat their nectar and pollen. How can you lose? Let's diversify the landscape.
That's Dr. Mae Barenbaum from University of Illinois. You mentioned the flower show. What is that weird thing about being here looking at flowers at the flower show?
Well, whenever I look at a flower, I'm used to looking for the insects that are visiting, and here we are indoors at Navy Pier in March, and there's no insects. It just seems unnatural to me.
You know, a lot of people, if they saw insects,
they would
reach for the spray can.
Yes, they would, which is a shame, because their flower's best friend is a bee.
Yeah. All right, before I let you go, one last thing. You mentioned that there's a new class of chemical that the EPA is looking at, and you also talked about what the Obama administration is doing and how it's been a particularly bee-friendly administration.
Yes, absolutely. Last June, President Obama issued an executive order that requires all federal agencies to examine their land use in order to make federal land more insect or pollinator friendly. And that's millions and millions of acres, even federal highway rights of way, national parks, all kinds of, in one fell swoop, we have federal agencies looking to diversify their landscapes. So to paraphrase President Obama, that's change I can believe in.
Well, what about this new class of pesticides?
The sulfoxaflores. Yeah, they're a lot like the neonics, and there's a lot of concern about them. And what we were saying earlier, it's not so much the chemicals themselves, but how they are used. Because what's going to happen if you ban any particular chemical class, there will be another class to come along, or an older version of a chemical.
Which might be actually worse.
Even worse. So, yeah. So before people talk about bans, they have to consider what will be used in place of whatever's eliminated. So a lot of these old chemistries are still around, and they're not off the market. So what has to be done is to develop pest and weed management practices that aren't so chemically reliant. The same thing with putting all your eggs in the pollinator basket. We put all our pest management eggs in a chemical control basket. And there are all kinds of tools for managing pests that are a little more environmentally sustainable.
You must be looking with interest at the ban on neonicotinoids in the EU.
Yeah, it's funny you should say that, because at the same time our honey yields are up and our number of colonies are up, France's are down, and France was one of the EU nations that banned two of the three, but on only certain crops. Uh-huh. Now the problem is, it's so variable year to year, largely because of climate, it's going to be impossible to tell what effect that ban has.
You have no control. I mean,
none.
You know, as a scientist, you
right.
want a control
none.
Factor, but you
right.
don't have a control.
So everyone will find evidence for his or her particular pet hypothesis.
Well, Dr. Mae Barenbaum, University of Illinois, entomologist, thank you so much. I hope you enjoy Attack of the Killers.
I can't wait to read it. Yes, thank you so much.
Thanks.
Sitting in the Chicagoland Gardening Magazine booth at the Chicago Flower and Garden Show this year,
I could immediately tell which gardeners had sun-starved yards. Well, duh, it was the ones looking at the books about shade gardening. But if you have the same problem, you might want to take a look at the March-April issue, which is on sale throughout the Chicago area right now. The feature article is called Treasures of the Woodlands, and while writer Carolyn Ulrich warns that you need to have the right conditions for some of these plants, you still might want to consider gems like marsh marigolds and Virginia bluebells and Dutchman's breeches and shooting stars and bloodroot. Heck, the names alone are worth the price of admission. The issue also comes with the extremely useful resource guide, which tells you how to find practically everything horticultural, from garden centers to arboreta to seeds to books to classes to you name it. The issue also has my column on the inside back page, but into every life some rain must fall. Chicagoland Gardening Magazine, a publication of state-by-state gardening magazines. Whether you're in Chicago, the Midwest, or the South, call 888-265-3600. 888-265-3600.
Spending more time at home these days? Give yourself some room. Renovate your basement or attic. You'll increase your living space and your home's resale value too.
Trust DR Services Unlimited, 847-998-1687, for your remodeling needs, including additions, renovations, and other home improvements. Rated A-plus by the Better Business Bureau and recommended on Angie's List. DR is a proud member of NARI. DR provides exceptional quality at a fair price. Contact DR at 847-998-1687 or at RestoreTheNorthShore.com.
I have Jennifer Walling, who's Executive Director of the Illinois Environmental Council, on the phone with me. Jennifer, how are you?
Good. Good morning.
It's good to talk to you. You guys, you know, at this time of year, you just gird your loins and go on down there and fight the fight, don't you?
Yep. This is usually the part of session where it's not even as bad. And getting to late May, it's going to be rough.
Yeah. You know, it's... You would think that democracy was a little tidier, but it ain't. Let me ask you, actually, if this is the way it happens. You work for months and you get all these bills together and you go and you talk to lawmakers and say, hey, this would make good policy, and you try to do it in a timely fashion, but it seems that invariably it ends up being the last second and things get crammed in, because I've listened to you and, you know, gotten notices from people saying, hey, it's all going to happen in the next 24 hours, so be ready for whatever comes down. It always ends up being a crunch at the end, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I would say that bills that don't have a lot of opposition move through at a pretty regular pace from January through May. I've got a lot of bills that have already gotten through one chamber already. But when it comes to the really big stuff and often the really bad stuff, that all tends to happen the last week in May. And, you know, I can think of every year I've done this, something just truly horrible that's been proposed or something that we're fighting for really hard that's hanging on for dear life. So, the biggest things that our community cares about often last part of May.
Well, I got a notice from you the other day, and I was kind of stunned at the sheer number of environmental bills that you're working on in Springfield this year. I want to go through as many of them as we can, but what I really want to start with is the electronics recycling bill. Mm-hmm. And kind of go through the history of that. That became law in, what, 2012, January 2012? Now, I could be wrong. It's either 2012 or 2013. But the point was that we were going to leap forward as a state. The state of Illinois was going to be more responsible about recycling its electronics. And at the time, it was a really good bill. And then something happened, and last year you began to see counties saying, well, we've run out of money, we can't help you with your electronics recycling anymore, in agencies that had been doing it for a long time and had been working with manufacturers and other entities to get electronics recycling done, suddenly we're saying we don't accept them anymore. I mean, Swalco in Lake County said, as of December 18th, we're not accepting any more electronics. And I went, what?
And they spent like $250,000 on recycling electronics when they shouldn't be.
So what happened?
You know, the e-waste bill originally passed in 2007, but the landfill ban took place in 2012.
Okay.
So there are certain electronics that are banned from the landfill, but we still haven't caught up in terms of places to take them. So basically, the way that the law works is that each manufacturer has a goal of what they need to collect in a year, and that goal is based on the weight of electronics that they sell. So in the time since we passed the bill, one of the big issues has been that, first, with the economy not doing as well, manufacturers are selling fewer products every year. And second, the products are getting lighter and lighter, so weight is not, you know, it means that the goal is actually going down. In a good program, you hope the goal is going up. And
can I stop you for a second?
Sure.
So it means that a manufacturer has to recycle based on what they sell. There's a percentage based on what they sell this year.
I think it's based on what they sold the previous year.
Okay, but as you say, if the electronics get lighter and lighter each year, that means that goal becomes smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that seems like it's a loophole in the bill.
Yeah, I think it's a loophole. And I think it's, you know, when we passed this bill, it wasn't something that we were contemplating happening. I mean, the trend had been for the number of electronics sold and the total weight to go up. I mean, we knew electronics were getting lighter, but, you know, there were more and more of them being sold. And, you know, with the recession hitting, there were a lot of companies that were selling fewer and fewer. So it didn't go the way that we thought. But so that's one factor. And then another factor has been that the manufacturers are offering the recyclers lower and lower prices to do the collection. And one of the negatives of that is that the municipalities and counties, particularly in the suburban areas, have just done an excellent job in collecting materials. And they have often borne the cost for things like transportation or other aspects of this law. And so, you know, it's meant that the manufacturers are passing off the cost to somebody else.
We've started to come back in terms of the economy. You would think that would increase the amount of recyclables. I mean, you're talking about 2008 and 2009 when the bottom dropped out. But here we are in 2013, 2014. You would think that the amount of recyclables would have increased by then, had it not?
I don't think that those numbers have really, I mean, it's gone up maybe a little bit, but I don't think those numbers have been going up. I think that, and I know those numbers haven't been going up in terms of the goals that have needed to be completed.
Yeah.
They're still not selling as much and just definitely selling way lighter products.
So what's the fix for this bill?
So, you know, there's sort of a short-term fix and a long-term fix. And I think that the short-term fix, obviously, is what we're pursuing right now, particularly for those municipalities and counties. And I think that what's going to be on the table is an adjustment of the goals. And so and there's two portions here, adjustment of the goals and then allowing something different to be done with CRT glass. One of the other issues has been, so CRT glass is in old monitors and old TVs, and it's...
And we should, let me stop you there. Cathode ray tube is what you're talking about.
Cathode ray tube. Yep, and it's got lead. It is very dangerous. It's not something that we want everywhere. But so there have been a few companies that have developed that reuse and recycle the material. For example, they'll put them in, they'll treat it and they'll put it in cement or ceramic tiles that can be used in homes. But there aren't very many companies, and it has been the most expensive portion to recycle. And so what we've proposed in this bill, And, you know, it's been something the environmental groups have had to agree to as well, because if we're ever going to increase the goals, we need to decrease the cost for what is this fantastically expensive portion. And so one of the suggestions that they're going to take is they are going to create a monofill at a landfill where treated CRT glass can be stored for basically mining later when there is a market for this glass. Because what's happening now is, and all over the country, there have been places that have closed that are collecting the CRT glass, and there were just big Superfund sites full of leaching lead. And, you know, we're just, it's meaning that we can't recycle any of the other electronic products. So in that case, we're going to decrease the manufacturer's costs of dealing with CRT glass, but at the same time increase their goals.
So it sounds like, and I don't want to get stuck on this bill too much, but it sounds like the CRT is this roadblock. It's this this funnel that everything goes into that's being blocked by this one thing that's holding up the rest of the bill. Is that the case? It sounds like we're being blocked by this old technology. We have to figure out how to deal with that before we can move forward.
Yeah, and you know, we should see within the next 5 years the really worst, because, you know, nobody buys, I mean, there's still portions that you need to do with the glass that is in, like, flat screen TVs, but nobody is buying those big TVs anymore. You know, eventually they're going to come out of the market.
All right, let's go to several others quickly. I notice that you're working on compost bills in the General Assembly, including a proposal to allow temporary and permanent drop-offs for composting and increasing compost usage. How are those bills different?
A lot of the bills actually came out of this big task force over the last year and a half that dealt with the advancement of materials recycling. So we have some compost bills and some really neat recycling bills. So the composting bills, one of them, well, they're both pretty easy things that we're getting done, but one of them, the mandatory reporting one, kind of lightweight, but it's our first attempt at really increasing the state's usage of compostable materials of compost materials in land activities. And we did this because there is a state preference for composting, for compost instead of soil in projects, but we're not using it. And a part of why we're not using it so much is because the way that the bids go out and the procurement is done, it'll be things like the procurement will say, I need 1 million cubic yards of soil right now. Well, for a composter, they can't do it right now, but actually for the project, they might need 1 million cubic yards over a few months, and a composter could comply with that if they needed to. That's what we want them to look at, so we can see if we can just voluntarily get them to use more compost in state projects. And roads are just a huge place. They do this in Texas. They use a lot of compost.
And what about this the drop-off for composting?
Yeah. So that one's really neat. So it comes out of last year, there were a number of residents that wanted to do pumpkin collection and to have it composted. And they contacted the IEPA, which may have been, you know, a bad idea to ask the question. But when they contacted IEPA, IEPA said, well, that's a transfer station, and you need a permit as if you're getting a transfer station, you know, for a one-day pumpkin drop-off.
Oh, boy.
And eventually, we talked them out of it, and they did a pilot program, and they, like, shoehorned it in under the household hazardous waste collection law, basically.
Yeah, because pumpkin, you know, pumpkin waste is so hazardous.
Yeah. But so they did it, and it's scarce. Kami came from scarce, and I think there was Will County did one, and maybe McHenry, but several counties, and there were at least 30 tons of pumpkins collected right after Halloween, which is really cool. But we decided that rather than do this pilot every time, we wanted to put something in statute that said that these are explicitly allowed. They're regulated. And actually what's really neat is eventually we thought we were going to have each of these sites get a permit from IEPA. But if you want to do this after the law passes, all you'll have to do is get permission from your municipality or county if you're in unincorporated areas. And it allows for two things. One is a one-day temporary drop-off, and the other is for permanent drop-off sites. So there's a few, like Lake County is going to experiment with putting out a container at their recycling drop-off site where you can bring your food scraps. And much like with recycling drop-offs, organics drop-offs are a really good first step in developing that demand and developing the infrastructure so that we're able to divert more of this material from the landfill.
Well, yeah, I worked with Kay McKean at Scarce last fall when she was doing the pumpkin drive, and I helped her get the word out, and it just seemed like such a great idea to compost this, and the fact that we don't have legislation that'll deal with that is frustrating, and that's why I'm glad you're doing it. The whole idea of food scrap composting, though, is very complex, and mm-hmm. I know it's done in other states. Where does Illinois stand in the issue of food scrap composting? Are we a backward state? Are we in the middle? I know we're not in the forefront of that.
No. I mean, there's some good aspects and some not so good. I would say we're in the middle. You know, we only basically legalized commercial food scrap composting in 2009. And, you know, there are maybe 10 sites that are permitted and accept large amounts of food scraps. So there aren't very many, although it has led to things like the city of Oak Park has organics collections that will mm-hmm. take food scrap. Highland Park experimented for a while. And actually, one of the areas that we just did in 2013, that puts us ahead of the curve is we've removed permitting for small sites, including urban farms and sites under 25 cubic yards. And, you know, Ohio just did this as well, but ours is comparable but a little bigger. So that actually leads a lot of options for urban farms, community gardens. We're just about to pass, we're working on a city ordinance with the city of Chicago to formalize that program in the city.
Yeah, so. I've been working with you on that, and it's a fascinating process.
Mm-hmm. I've never done that before.
but it is important. Mm-hmm. You know, the idea that we have food scraps and they're going into landfills is not good, and especially because this is such a valuable resource.
Mm-hmm.
Before we wrap up here, these are the things that have been kind of on my radar, but I bet you have issues that you're really focused on. What is it that keeps you up at night when you're dealing with the General Assembly and that you're trying to see get through?
Well, I mean, our biggest issue right now, clean energy. Trying to pass major expansions of renewable energy and energy efficiency laws and bring 32,000 jobs to Illinois. That one's going to be extremely difficult, but we're spending a lot of time on it.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of moving parts there. You've mm-hmm. got utilities and you've got other interest groups involved in that. I talk to Lisa Albrecht from the Illinois Solar Energy Association all the time about that, and it's really difficult, and I hope you can get it done.
I think that things are trending pretty well. I mean, just especially the in-depth analysis and the expertise all the groups are bringing, that's great. So, but, and just sort of trending into kind of what is my second biggest issue, the budget is going to be an issue that might overtake everything. And actually, very fresh for today, I have some good news.
Okay.
You know, they're right now there's a budget hole for FY15, and we've been watching the fund sweeps, and the fund sweep bill just came up, HB 318, basically this morning, and there are no sweeps to OSLAD, the Open Space Land Acquisition Development Fund, which is really important to us for parks, natural areas, land acquisition. And that did not get swept in this morning's bill.
So when you say sweep, so the average person listening to it, what does that mean? Taking funds from one thing and taking, you know, moving to them to another? Is that basically it?
Well, it's a little more insidious than that, because there are a bunch of fees and taxes that Illinoisans pay that passed or they agreed to pay because they knew it was going to a specific thing. So it's not just in your general income tax. So, for example, with OSLAD, there's a real estate transfer tax when you're purchasing real estate that goes on everything, and that money is directed to this fund that pays for open space and parks, et cetera, so it goes to OSLAD. And, you know, that fee was increased specifically for that purpose, very highly supported, and the proposal is to take money from a fee like that and just put it into the general revenue fund, which, yes, of course, you know, there are some really troubling priorities of things that haven't got funded, for example, this year, child care assistance, but it's kind of a way of raising taxes to pay for things in the general revenue fund without actually raising revenue. So, you know, you're taking something from a fund that's supposed to go somewhere and putting it somewhere else. You know, the way they're going to deal with this FY15 budget is completely through these type of sweeps. And we were pleased to see OSLAD wasn't on there. There is the Natural Areas Acquisition Funds going to be swept and several energy funds, but, you know, the damage was not as bad as it could have been. So that's actually, you know, a nice thing to hear this morning.
Yeah, but, you know, that's the legislature. The other thing you have to deal with is the governor. We have a new governor, Bruce Rauner, who's a Republican. How does that color everything that you're doing?
Well, I mean, it's definitely been a transition because all of the staff that I generally work with has changed, whether it's in agencies or within the governor's office. You know, I had some concerns about what would happen when he took office, but, you know, we've really had a really great level of communication with his office and with the agency staff. They worked with us to get bills done and been very professional in that aspect. So, you know, I think that's been going okay, but of course, this is not something that is a priority for the governor. We'll see as it goes ahead, and we'll see what he does when he's asked to sign bills.
Except for the IDNR, which he supports having some funding for, doesn't he?
Yeah. His budget did not cut the Department of Natural Resources very much at all. It applied some cuts to the Conservation Police and state museums, but it didn't cut state parks at all. Which I, of course, don't think state parks could withstand a cut at this point.
Yeah.
Just with, you know, the overwhelming amount of capital needs at most of these places.
Right.
Our energy is going to be the real test.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
You know, we don't have any real indications where they're going to be on our clean energy bill.
Which we desperately need. Jen Walling, Executive Director of the Illinois Environmental Council. I'm sure I'll be talking to you soon. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike. I'll talk to you.
Hi, I'm Peggy, and I've got great news about Natural Awakening Chicago. We're now available throughout the city and suburbs, from Lake County to the Indiana state line. If you own a green business or offer healthy living or wellness products and services, you should be working with our marketing team to get your message out to our targeted audience. Join us, won't you? We're online at nachicagonorth.com or call us today at 847-858-3697. Natural Awakenings. Feel good. Live simply, laugh more.
Well, it's a lovely March day in the city of Chicago. I wake up and look out the front window, and there I see, looks like a couple inches of snow at least. Now, that's not so unusual, really, in the city of Chicago in March. It does happen. But when you start talking climate change and things like the warmest winter ever recorded on the planet, then it gets a little weird and people don't quite follow what's going on, which is why I always turn to meteorologist Rick DeMaio. And Rick, good morning. I hope, have you been out there shoveling yet?
Shoveled, took the dog for a walk, took the kid to school, came back, and did some work around the house, setting myself up for tomorrow, and now talking to you. So my morning started at 6:30.
You got a lot done in by the time I have my first cup of coffee.
Yeah, I'm on number two, but that's usually a limit for me. You know, you talk about snow in the month of March, Mike. It was just last Monday. You know, we had temperatures in the low to mid-70s across the area. And you talk about the extremes that typically happen in the month of March, and getting, you know, a 70-degree day in early March and a snow in the middle or towards the end of the month is not uncommon, because we know that whatever snow we get usually doesn't last too long. But as much as people don't like getting snow on the 23rd of March, this is one of those snows where we can actually use because we've been so dry across the area.
Yeah, we have. In fact, I think I shot you an email the other day to say I was concerned about that, because we had that big snow way back at the beginning of February. We dumped 19 inches here, and since mm-hmm. then, not a whole lot.
Yeah, we up until the 22nd of March, this was going down as the third driest March up to this point, dating all the way back to 1871. And something that I had noticed on the lawns, Mike, up here in Evanston, I kept seeing this kind of webby-looking, mossy-looking, moldy-looking substance on the grass, and I didn't really think too much of it. And then I had a couple people ask me about it, and I didn't really know anything until I was alerted to a news story, and it was something called snow mold. You heard
about
it, didn't you?
Yeah. When you started describing it, that's what I was going to say, is probably snow mold.
Yeah, and I don't think I've ever seen it around here, although living in the city for as long as I did, I didn't really get to see a lot of grassy lawns, but I don't remember ever even seeing it or hearing about it in the 30 years I've been here. Is that something that's new to you as well?
No, you get it from time to time. It's, as you say, it's related to snow, and it's, as far as I know, a fungal disease. I'm not quite up on it as much as I should, but I do know one thing about taking care of it is, obviously, when this the current snow melts and things dry off and it's warm enough to mow, and you know, it's still way early. Folks needn't be worrying about their lawns at this point. Mm-hmm. But at some point when your lawn does start to grow, what you do with snow mold is, I normally, when people mow, I urge them to keep the blades, the cuttings on the lawn, because it puts nitrogen back into the soil. But the mm-hmm. but the first cut of the year, especially if you've had a problem, a disease like snow mold, that is the one you bag. Get it out of there.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Good idea there.
Yeah, because then you're getting rid of that disease and you start with a clean slate. So when you do mow for the first time, especially if you've had some snow mold, just bag that those clippings and get rid of them.
Sounds like a good idea. I noticed that there were several people who had never seen anything like that before. They were concerned. So it didn't seem like the people who were giving advice were overly concerned about it. They thought it would just go away. But obviously, you make a good point from a standpoint of getting the maintenance done the proper way. And, you know, this way you'll have, a nice green lawn come hopefully the first week of May. She was alluding to earlier about globally the warmest winter on record. If you look at it from a national standpoint, the lower 48 on a scale of 1 to 122, the winter turned out to be number 102. That's because you have to add in the fact that it was pretty cold across much of the Northeast and the Great Lakes in the month of February. And when you think back to the kind of pattern that we had around here in retrospect, it started out very mild in the month of December. We had some fairly good shots of cold weather in the month of January. And then, as you mentioned earlier, we've had that massive snow on the 1st and 2nd of February, which lasted the entire month into the first couple of days of March. And that really laid the groundwork for a lot of the cold air over Canada to be able to stretch itself southward. The Great Lakes reached 90% ice coverage. That was the second greatest ever. But it wasn't so much that it hit 90%. The length of time that it was above 70 to 75 to 80 was much less than what it was last year. However, the Great Lakes still have ice on them, and the lakes are still cold, and this is one of the reasons why we're getting the snow today, is the fact that the low levels are so cold, the little clipper system moving out of the southwest, depositing what would have been a rain over us, the precipitation is turning into snow. So this is one way that the winter affecting the Great Lakes is obviously impacting our March as well. Still temperatures during the day on Sunday made it into the 70s as far east as eastern sections in Nebraska while we were getting snow across Minnesota. So the month of March typically produces some wild variations in weather, and this one, no doubt, not any different. The only thing that we see lacking, Mike, is really the lack of any significant amounts of severe weather or rain systems across the Central Plains. Those areas continue to be very quiet and continue to be very dry, something they've done pretty much throughout much of the month of March, February, and even parts of January as well.
Getting back, though, to the idea that this is kind of an anomaly for our area, that, you know, this is something we've gone through for the last 2 years, which is if you look at maps of the globe, and I just did, and you look at how the whole planet is heating up, and with the exception, there are very few exceptions on the planet, and one of those is the Midwest here in North America. And it confuses people. They think, well, you know, we're heating up. Is that anomaly connected to the global pattern?
I think it is. I think cold air masses always like to find areas where they can stay cold. And when you get into the area of the Great Lakes, obviously Chicago is a city on the Great Lakes, but we're on the western edge of the Great Lakes. And we're impacted, obviously, by Lake Michigan pretty much throughout the springtime and during the fall as well. In the wintertime, when the lakes really begin to cool down, they almost act as a land surface. In other words, they get so cold that the lakes really don't have that much of an impact on us. But this year, when the lakes really began to ice up, particularly across Lake Superior, Lake Huron, Lake Ontario, those lakes, once they begin to freeze up, the cold air masses that develop more so in the second half of the winter season typically become a little bit stronger, a little bit more intense, and they push a little bit further southward. So your anomalies from a standpoint of how cold you get and how long you stay cold generally tend to be a little bit more extreme and generally tend to last a little bit longer. If you look back at the period in the mid-90s, when we had, you know, very warm winters pretty much from beginning to end, the lakes never iced up, and the transition from winter to spring went pretty quickly. But last year and so far this year, we've seen a transition that has been much slower. Now, granted, we're only in the third week of March, but the lakes still have quite a bit of ice on them across Lake Superior, Lake Huron. So those anomalies from a standpoint of how they look on a global map, you'll probably still see a lot of blue over the Great Lakes in the Northeast, particularly New England. I would say through the month of March into April and maybe into May as well, until there's a definite shift from a global standpoint of no longer a big ridge over the western United States and a big trough over the east. Will those anomalies begin to flatten out? But it was interesting, again, looking back at this winter, which... You don't really want to say in retrospect when you look outside and there's 4 inches of snow on the ground, but the pattern really went right back to where it was last year, which was very dry, very warm across the Central Plains into the Rocky Mountains, and very cold and snowy in the Great Lakes, particularly into the Northeast and New England. Even though with the 4 inches of snow, Chicago's snowfall total is now up to 49 inches. That's not bad, but you can say you hit 50 inches and the normal is 35. New York City this month, a month of March, Mike, has had 18 inches of snow, and they're up to 57 inches. Boston, as you heard probably earlier, broke their all-time record at 108. So you go into the Northeast and New England, and particularly Eastern Great Lakes, they've had a lot more snow than we have. And that kind of was the way last winter worked out, when Chicago had 82 inches of snow, Rockford only had 57, and parts of the Northern Plains were only in the 30s and 40s. So the pattern shifted a little bit further to the east, and then consequently, we got into some very dry air in the month of March.
We're talking to meteorologist Rick DeMaio. One more thing I want to bring up before I let you go is an interesting policy change at the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. They just updated their guidelines for state disaster preparedness plans. And under the new policy, plans will only be approved, and we're talking plans, and I'm not talking about emergency aid after a disaster, but I'm talking as you plan for disaster, those funds will only be approved if they address the threats of climate change. That's kind of an interesting development by the Obama administration, but it seems to make total sense to me.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of ifs then, what exactly... is climate change to particular regions. I was going through a American Meteorological Society bulletin, publication. It's called the Bulletin of the AMS from 2008, and the front page article was about a new look at storm surge forecasts for the New York City area. And when I looked at it probably 7 years ago, I just kind of said, oh, yeah, it's kind of cool. I kind of thumbed through it. But now I'm looking through it in a different way because obviously with what happened with Hurricane Sandy last year, you go, whoa, wait a minute. Was this, article right? Did it address certain things? And did people just kind of brush it off? So I think, in certain areas, climate change, obviously across the Western United States, California, right now, from what I see, Mike, they're heading into a worse situation drought-wise than they were last year at this time. The amount of area that's under exceptional drought is about 10 to 15% greater than what it was last year, and now they're heading into one more month of potential wetness before they get into a dry season. So climate change, obviously, for California, you have to think about soil, moisture, the type of trees that you plant, how much you use your aquifers, or I should say your reservoirs. When you get into the plain states, where you rely more on the aquifers, then you have to start to think more about what type of resources you have when you're trying to maintain your herds of cattle. When you get obviously into the Gulf Coast region, then you're talking about the wetlands, you're talking about the marshlands. Those areas from, say, Houston over to Mobile Bay in Pensacola, where you're dealing more with protecting, different beach environments. I was walking along the dunes of Wilmette along Lake Michigan the other day, and I was with my son, and he was beginning to walk on the beach grass. I said, no, you can't do that. You got to stay off the grass because that's what holds the dunes in place. And we don't really think about them much here because, we don't really think about storm surges, but every time that you have a large storm along the lakefront, if it destroys some of those dunes and there's no grass holding into place, those dunes are gone. So similar to how rising sea levels and the increased nature of the intensity of storms in the Gulf Coast and the possibility of rising storm surges, will ruin those particular wetlands. And then, of course, here in the Chicagoland area, we have four seasons to worry about. I still don't think lake levels are going to be that much of a problem to us. They go down and they go up on their own. I've seen such dramatic changes in the last few years that there's really not much we can do because the lakes are a little bit more self-contained. You get into larger urban areas when you think about population and how to protect people from, severe weather and heat waves and things like that. I think climate change has so many different little tentacles that it's going to be really hard for the administration to lay out a blueprint that covers everything. You're going to almost have to address not only regions, but also urban areas, suburban areas, ex-urban areas, meaning, the wildlife areas, and obviously agriculture as well. So while it may sound like a great idea, boy, there's a Talk about putting a blanket over a problem that exists. But boy, you're gonna have to do a lot of work to really make sure that blanket is more specific than just saying climate change, you need to work with us on this.
Yeah, you're right. It's so variable, and there's so many nuances to it, and that is part of the problem, is because it can manifest itself in so many different ways in different areas. Well, we'll see what happens to that. And by the way, I was just checking with Iowa State University about snow mold here. And there are a couple of them. There's a gray snow mold and there's a pink snow mold. Do you know which
one?
Right,
I've seen that one, yeah.
It's basically the problem comes when people don't cut their lawns in the fall. You know, you want to cut it, you know, just up to when it stops growing and not give a place for the mold. And it is a fungus, as I mentioned before. According to Paula Flynn at Iowa State, she says to prevent snow mold damage from reoccurring, avoid late fall applications of quick-release nitrogen fertilizers because the growth in the fall is more susceptible to the attack, and you keep it mowed until the growth is stopped in the fall. And then in the spring, you can repair by raking the affected areas and by lightly, and I emphasize lightly, fertilizing to encourage new growth. If you have excessive thatch, more than a half inch of dead plant material found between the soil and the leaf blades, that should be controlled because it provides a place for the fungus to hide during the summer months. And you might also want to improve your drainage. So but basically, it sounds like people did not get around to cutting their lawn at the end of the season, and that sets
right.
up the conditions for the snow mold. There you go.
And Mike, one more thing on the snow mold. I think the best way to really describe the transition from no mold to snow mold is we had a very warm month of December. The ground was very mild or had temperatures that
right.
were in that upper 30 range. And even though we got cold in January, there was also several times where we had a fair amount of sun and the ground temperature was pretty warm, relatively speaking. So when we did get that 19 inches of snow, it basically sealed the moisture and it sealed the warmth in. So it was almost like the ground was very damp and kind of warm before the snow actually, fell. And then we had literally 32 consecutive days where the snow was on the ground, and you had this slow percolation of soil, percolation of wetness into the soil. You had no evaporation. So like anything else, you take a towel or two towels, and the bottom towel is wet, you put a towel above it, and you don't put any heat on it, that towel is going to get moldy.
Yeah.
So the atmosphere almost acted like it was supposed to. And even though, and I stress this, even though we've had a very dry period, that doesn't mean that there's not a lot of moisture in the ground. This has been a very nice, slow melt-off of snow. We had nearly an inch of water in that snow, and it didn't really evaporate into the atmosphere, what we call sublimation. It was a very slow percolation that didn't run off. So I got a feeling going into this spring, Mike, or I should say growing season, as dry as it's been, I have a feeling that the plants, the roots, your trees, the lawns are going to do pretty well once we begin to get some sunshine and warmer temperatures. Dryness of precipitation falling doesn't mean that the ground is actually dry as well.
All right.
We've had a lot of good moisture soaking into the soil, and it's been doing it slowly too.
Okay, that's Rick DeMaio, and of course, anybody's listening throughout the country knows that we're talking basically about the Chicago area and the Midwest. Not everybody had 19 inches of snow at the beginning of February, but there was a lot of snowpack on the ground in the Midwest and greater part of the country. So, Rick, always a pleasure talking to you, and the next time something crazy happens with the weather or the climate, I'm going to give you a call.
Sounds good, Mike. Have yourself a good Monday and a good week.
Well, I got to get the shovel out. I'll talk to you soon.
You can find more information about the Mike Novak Show at mikenovak.net. That's MikeNowak.net for links, photos, and commentary.